Oh, welcome to Scandal.org. This week we have a little bit of a mixed bag in this podcast, so stay tuned and enjoy. First up, we have a conversation with Canadian visitors in Nimbim. Welcome, you're visiting Nimbim and you're from Canada, may I ask? You are Joan?
I'm Joan, yeah.
And Bob Marley.
That's wonderful, we've got another one. he's a Corey, actually. Anyway, welcome to Nimbim. I was interested, as you being from Canada, of how pot politics will shape up in the future with the new leader of your country being elected recently.
I think they'll go to pot. In other words, they're gone.
It's true. I agree 100%. I haven't seen improvement for years either.
No, but they have a new government in now, and it's the conservative government. At least the liberal government was more open to decriminalization, things like that. But the new government, I don't think so. I don't think it's going to be. They're going to try to reverse everything and make it a criminal offense again.
Mm. Yeah. So I heard on other news from over there, from the internet, that 8 states in the United States have also had some improvement in their legislation recently, with most of them medicinal cannabis users with supervision are now permitted to use cannabis for their treatment, and in 3 states, I couldn't quite figure it was Alaska,
California.
California.
Yeah, there is like sort of shift from the felony charge to a misdemeanor, and like the lightening of the charges that happened in the
Well, from our understanding, it's recognized by the state, but not by the federal government.
By not the federal government.
And so they are the ones that...
So the people are still getting busted.
Right, so that's the overriding power, so the police on the ground in place.
Yeah.
Just like here.
Yeah.
Pretty much. It's global, I believe, you know.
Yeah. Well, if this is, indicates when there's a shift in 8 states of the U.S. from a very hard line before, do you think there's a softening up globally coming from that, when you say globally?
Not from the states, and I think Canada is going to start to lie down with the states now because of the change in government, and there's going to be a reversal.
Right,
I think they're going to be more strict on it.
And can people in the states, the electorate, actually influence their politics in that sense on the ballot boxes, so you know?
Well, I think one big concern right now is they feel that any type of illegal substance is going to be supporting some sort of war.
Yeah.
And so they don't want to have any encouragement into anything, even, you know, as mild as marijuana. But, you know, I'm sure they're just going to continue clamping down for that main reason.
Yeah.
They recognize the benefits of it, and there are medicinal reasons that you can take illegally, I believe. Isn't this true?
Yeah, they have outlets that if you have a prescription from your doctor, and I mean, we know people, who friends of ours, who do this, they have outlets in the states where you can go and buy just about anything you want, but you have to have this prescription, and you have to have
go
through the process, right?
Well, this is the coffee machine's gig. but it's all right. We're just cutting over it.
It's good coffee, though.
And there's a credibility factor that it's authentic. It's not made up. It's a synthetic studio, you know. It's not coming from a chip. Come back to the pot topic in Canada and maybe in the States. You probably know a bit because you live there next door.
Yeah.
How does it feel to live next door?
Quite nerving at times.
We actually lived in LA for 5 years and we loved it. It was great, but I mean, Canada's getting more anti-US as the years go on. That's my opinion. I mean, no, they were, you know, it's more and more than what they used to be. And I mean, now it's like when the U.S. tells them to do things, like they want to cross the border, and people want to cross the border with pot, and they're getting arrested, and it's because the state says, no, you can't bring it in.
Yeah.
but Canada says, well, yeah, I'm a Canadian, I can bring it in. So, I mean they're even they're trying to, what do you call it, not deport, what do you call it when someone gets arrested on something and they want to bring them to another country, back to another country?
Rendition. A rendition for other purposes.
So extradition.
The extradition, that's it. He had sold pot seeds or something by mail into the States, and he's in Canada now, and they're trying to extradite him to the States and charge him. For like 3 years in jail.
What's his position?
He's like the head of the... There is a pot party in Canada that promotes...
Oh, this guy who runs a magazine.
Yes,
he does.
I've never read this magazine, but I'm not familiar with politics.
But he's from Vancouver, and they have a...
It's very prevalent, and it's old.
Mark Emery, is that
the
name?
I don't remember his name.
I'm not sure. I'll find out with the experts here.
But they're trying to extradite him to the States so they can arrest him and charge him because he sold seeds in the States.
Well, that's my question anyway. How strong is that American influence into your country from, say, politics or from the general justice exercise?
I think it depends on the government, because the other government is in now, we might have a problem.
That's true.
Well, it's a bit like Australia, isn't it?
Yeah.
Again, a global situation.
It really is.
Okay, well, I'll hold it for a moment. I might have another question.
Okay.
Yeah, it was just sort of off-air talking a little bit about listening in and listening in different countries, and it seems like men are spreading around. What do you reckon, Bob?
Oh,
we're listening in now, so choose your words carefully.
You're being listened to. I know nothing.
John, what do you think?
No.
Anyway, it's sort of a spreading phenomenon going around. I'd find the best weapon against it is to be totally transparent and not to hide anything. And to be in multiple places stored and copied and mirrored on many, many web servers all around the planet.
Well, they've
it's very, very hard to shut down, you know.
You got to find the plague.
They've
and always get it out
they're
first,
they're
you know.
They're like fishing for things, you know. It's
fishing in
innocent
waters.
They're just being silly, you know.
Nothing is ever known until after the fact, it seems like, you know. We never have a heads up on anything.
Yeah.
And every day you wake up waiting for the next thing to happen. Yeah, and it's major, every day.
Big Cheney standing in the door and trying to shoot you.
Well, my friend looked like a quail.
Okay, well.
But we did see the platypus this morning.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for that.
We're still alive. Okay, well, we don't eat them. They taste horrible.
No, okay. We'll remember that.
But
nothing a little cheese can't fix.
Yeah, I just wonder, you're visiting Australia and Nimbin today, and I was wondering whether you consider to change the side, or it doesn't really matter then between the legislation in Canada and Australia. It looks like a mirror image.
It sounds like a blueprint
coming out of Karl Rove and what is this guy, Paul Wolfowitz?
Exactly.
You know, there's an underlying fact of what's going on is a good thing, but it all comes down to the money again, the government, and society and community, and there's going to be control.
Yeah.
And to have that control, I mean, there have to be rules and laws.
And if the government can find a way to make money on it themselves by legalizing or doing whatever, they would do it. Because, I mean, you have tobacco, you have alcohol. Yeah. What's the difference?
Yeah.
Well, there's a big difference in those people who use this stuff, I noticed, but...
we're more milder.
That's still an individual's decision,
it's different
isn't
for
it?
Everybody.
Yeah, it's sure different for everybody.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that. I'll forward that to the hemp hours and might have fun with it.
All right.
You know what? When you're broke, you know, that is, I'm not quite broke, but I've got $5 left, and I have a big decision to make today. What I spend $5 on, because $5 doesn't buy you a soup and a drink. It only buys you a drink or a soup. You can't have it both. You can have the soup without the bread, or you can have the bread without the soup. So what do you do when you're left with $5 to spend until days and days to wait for your next payment? Well, listen to this. There are many, many, many things people can do with $5 bills, and there are many, many thoughts about that.
seen one glued on an ATM slot, next to an ATM slot, a $5 bill. It's glued on, you can't pick it up.
Oh, yeah. Yes, and what do they do that for?
That's sort of these people who want to smash the jam, the hammer into the works, you know.
They do.
Culture jamming.
Yeah.
So it's very active. It's really bringing the banks down rapidly, you know, and financial institutions are moaning about the attacks on ATMs with false glued
$5
note.
I must inform you, I actually work for the $5 note commission.
Oh, yes.
Yes, the rights of $5 notes have been... We decided to recognise the rights of a $5 note, and we defend the right of the $5 note not to be used in this mockery.
So pay respect.
We're asking people to report abuse of $5 notes.
Yeah.
1-800-661-669 or
okay.
Whatever w.com.
Yeah. Yeah. We're monitored. That will be replicated anyway, so we don't need to repeat it.
So it's wonderful that we have these bodies that protect the rights of the
$5 note. And what would that imply in them?
Well, like a $5 note, the right of a $5 note to me would be where if it's got X value today, tomorrow it'd have minus X value and so on down the track, so eventually that $5 note could be, it could be just a piece of paper like it really wanted to be in the first place. Mm-hmm. Or, what is it? Plastic.
It's a piece of plastic, yes.
Can you stick it in the tank and drive the car?
No, what
the carburetor
would you get
doesn't like $5 bills, I believe.
Well, according to the Rights Commission, the $5 bill has a right to live its natural term of its life and not be abused on the way and not be used, made use of, politically.
I heard that the natural lifespan of $5 bill is 3 nanoseconds, Graham. What do you reckon?
Well, I don't know. The $1 bill didn't last very long.
No.
And so I think its days are numbered, because it's getting less valuable every day.
What's $5? It's a tip for the waiter.
The commission of the $5 bill has a right to as much respect as a $20 bill or a $50.
Shouldn't just end up in the tip.
Yes, just because it's a $5 basket. Bill.
That's not a basket case.
Considered discrimination.
Yes. And what about religious and like racist and gender-based accusations of $5 bills? Allegations.
Well, we haven't seen much racial attitude towards the $5 bill, but we have seen the $5 bill used in racial incidents. Yes, and that's what the $5 bill committee is objecting to.
That would be a punishment.
Yeah, the $5 bill has a right not to be used in stunts at all.
In religious circles or context. Any incidents reported on that?
Well, even in the Vatican, you know, the $5 bill has been fighting a battle for many years now to be seen as equal to the $100 bill.
Has it been yet recognised for sainthood?
No. We're still step number one. We're still actually getting them to be interested in allowing $5 bills to be put in the collection box.
Do we find out when the white smoke comes up? What signal is the signal for being approved into sainthood?
For the $5 bill?
Yeah. What sort of thing does the $5 bill need to be elevated to sainthood in the Vatican?
It needs to be seen for what it is, a $5 bill.
You
agree.
You hinted that $5 might not stay $5 for very long.
Well, it'll still be a $5 bill so valueless that it will probably disappear as it wants to do. I mean, that is the ultimate aim of a $5 bill, is to become absolutely redundant. And once it's redundant, it's retired, you see. And everybody needs to have a retirement, even a $5 bill. And so we're protecting the rights.
And that's one of the rights of the $5 bill, is for it to accrue its retirement fund. And how can it do that if it's glued to a bloody ATM?
So what's happening when it gets to its end of its life? Does it get a decent funeral? Is there any funeral ideas for $5? Thank you.
I think the $5 bill in all currencies probably got the same view, and that is to be allowed to decay in peace.
In peace.
It's work all its life, as money, accrue its interest as superannuation, and then live its last remaining days in decay.
And when he's knocked on heaven's door,
peacefully, like, do you think it would end up like being buried, or would it go up in flames in the
I reckon it needs burning first before it can be reincarnated.
Because at the moment there's prejudice. The $5 bill, nobody wants to address the question. The $100 bill, carpet. Again, it's the whole and this is why the organisation came together, is that money has had enough of taking the blame.
Okay, so the $5 bill's gone, so the $10 bill then becomes the $5 bill, and the 20 becomes the 10, and the 50, it becomes the 20, and the $100 bill becomes the 50. So that leaves, at the top end of town, it leaves a vacancy.
Shall we try then so to then glue
we need a
$500
bill?
We could elevate that and put a $500 bill on the ATM with Super Bowl.
Well then, it'd give us more time.
It'd take longer to
end up like the $5 bill.
So there's no chance it will ever come back with a different denomination from a different country reincarnated in some form or another?
Well, so instead of having a wheelbarrow full of paper money, you just have a note with hundreds of zeros after the one.
That seems to be the view from currency in general, is that if you're serious about your protest, then surely a $1,000 bill is minimum.
$1,000 bill, I think it's inevitable. Yes.
What for? I didn't get it.
To post on the ATM machine or to glue to the footpath.
To demonstrate the act.
To demonstrate the value of currency.
The money is, it's not the fault of the money, as you just said. It's the fault of the actor.
The actor?
Of the user of the money.
The usury?
It's the fault of the mime artist who stops on the footpath and thinks that no one's looking when it picks up the $5 bill.
I think there's a factor there in that usury thing. It's another factor involved. So, there's a lot more to be investigated in this discussion.
I know there's great interest in
There is, like 5.5% at the moment. That's if you invest in the Commonwealth Bank, but
which bank? Yeah, okay.
So there's a lot of interest.
You can lose several percentage of investing in money. It's easy to lose a few percent of your money.
Yeah, percentage. That's right.
The bank fees, the charges, the government revenue, the interest rates collapsing.
GST. So
almost guaranteed you lose money putting it in the bank, I reckon.
It has many branches.
Yes, it has. You can put in any branch you like, and that's so you can get it out quickly. You don't have to go to the trunks.
The trunk.
Go to the roots.
No roots.
Don't have
just the right branch.
Just the right branch. You need no grounding at all in this. Right. You need have nothing to do with roots and earth.
If you have to go to the roots, you're a bit of a sap.
What happens when people take $5 bills to a casino, which is sort of, it's not quite black market, but it's sort of money which is, very hard to control on individuals these days and governments. You've got no handle on it when someone plays in the casino and says, I lost $15,000 tonight, nobody can disprove it.
Well, I don't know, I'd leave all that alone.
Isn't that
I think
a worry for the financial institutions? Money which is not accounted for.
Yeah, meta. I like that word because, the Greek meta. It's a good word. And you can have
meta investments.
Yes, you can have foracles. They're good too. And you can have metaphoricals. Huge foracles.
We already established you can't eat it, so there's no good, no point trying to eat it. You need to convert it into something which is useful.
Convert. Well,
from Catholic Vatican $5 near sainthood money to some bread or bread, soup or.
Well, see, you talk about appetite. Now, appetite has to be sated somehow. So you would
probably have to
do something like what you suggest. What do you suggest?
Well, there is an argument for transparency.
Ah.
Yeah.
So $5 bill
could be seen, could be transparent and therefore seen as anything, really.
So if you put your teeth into it and your dentures fall out, if it's transparent, you can see where they are.
Yeah.
Grab them back again. Yeah. I like it. Yeah, it's very sad.
Hello and welcome. Today I will be speaking to Ian Brown, who is a passionate environmental and cultural educator and has been researching the possible impacts of global warming on the subtropical coastline communities of Eastern Australia and the southern region of the United States of America. He has studied both horticultural and natural resource management in Sydney, tropical ecology in Darwin, and is a current graduate education studies student at Lismore Southern Cross University here in subtropical northern New South Wales, and where he has also been working on improving the ecological functioning of this largest region of Mother Earth's subtropical rainforest community. Welcome, Ian.
Why, many thanks, Martin, for the privilege of precious airtime to discuss some of the possible future impacts due to the world's lust for the carbon trade economy and the burning of fossil fuels.
Well, so why make a link in this instance between Australia and the United States of America and their varying climatic zones with global warming in?
Well, what do the two largest per capita nations contributors of carbon fuel emissions in the Western world have in common? Yep, you guessed it, subtropical wetlands. Not only are Australia and the United States doing their utmost to increase global warming, thus influencing climatic change and the ecological functioning of natural habitats, but both nations too have caused significant destruction of important wetland and marine habitats along their subtropical regions' coastlines.
How do both nations compare as far as the types of human impacts causing such destruction in these aquatic environments?
Well, Martin, as many local northern New South Welshmen are aware, in Australia's case, it is the industrial and urbanisational development of our beautiful coastline that has seen the destruction of important native Melaleuca and Casuarina tree wetland communities to make way for the financial gains and to facilitate Australia's east coast's rising sea change population. It is ironic that we are both discussing both subtropical regions of these two nations here in question, because Melaleuca, a relative of the eucalyptus in the Myrtaceae family, and the Casuarina tree, or known in Miami, Florida as the Australian pine tree, and in this case Casuarina pacifica, are represented in the Florida Everglades as a horrifying weed problem. Yet back here in Oz, we are scratching our heads at trying to find a solution to try and support a growing coastal population, and at the same time preventing destruction of precious wetland habitats. Along New South Wales' neighbouring Queensland Gold Coast region, corridors developed by councils to protect important rainforests and in some cases wetland communities have since been abolished, removed to allow for the development of highways and urban communities, especially as Brisbane, just to the north, is the fastest growing region in Australia alongside Sydney.
And in the United States?
Well, of course, the United States has a population nearing 300 million. Compared to Australia's 20 million, and where the United States isn't all that much larger in area, really, on a global scale compared to Oz, the States is blessed with sheltered subtropical gulfs and delta systems, allowing for healthy levels of biodiversity to occur. That's seen as in Australia's Kakadu monsoon wetland regions in the Northern Territory and in the tropical mangrove habitats in northern Queensland. Unfortunately, the pressures associated with a large population and the past mismanagement of the environment in the steamy southern states, due in part to the ignorance of past days that all nations are guilty of, has seen the halting of huge water recharge areas such as the damming of the headwaters to the Florida Everglades and the formation of an oil pipeline canal scarring Louisiana marsh and wetlands. This has led to ecosystems in both states being left high and dry and in other areas continuously waterlogged and in effect dispelling seasonal and climatic fluctuations influencing the natural ecological functioning of these wetland systems. including preventing hugely significant springtime nutrient and sediment flows from the Mississippi River, not to mention the saltwater incursions up and into these human-formed canals. This also led to the forewarned problems associated with the Hurricane Katrina storm surge a year or so back in the New Orleans area, etc., where levees were never going to prevent the ocean from moving into the Gulf's natural barriers, which have been scoured since the 1960s to bring oil onshore for state revenue gains. The Florida Everglades and the Louisiana wetlands are subtropical hotspots for biodiversity and are used as breeding and nursery habitats by hundreds of aquatic fish, endemic and migrating birds, and reptiles such as the infamous alligator. There has been some flow rate increases into the Florida Everglades, thankfully, and public concern in Louisiana for the restoration of wetlands is apparent, but as oil wins the dollars, this has been a slow process. Perhaps the misfortunes dealt out by the hurricane may persuade governments to act on environmental gains. In northern New South Wales and southern Queensland, restoration projects too have seen private land grants and council projects, etc., aiding in the restoration of important wetland and rainforest regions. There are actually more species of birds found on the Queensland and New South Wales border rainforest region than either Kakadu or the tropical rainforests of northern Queensland, so this is all very important.
Yes, we do love our rainforest in New South Wales, don't we?
We certainly do, and this leads me to my, and I'm sure many other people's, possible future global warming forecasts. If our wetlands are diminishing and global warming sees a tropification, a word I invented for you and our valuable listeners, Martin, the tropification of states north of Florida, from Georgia into warm temperate regions northward, and southern Queensland and New South Wales here in Australia, then it is only natural that exotic new wanderers will soon charm us, we the people frequenting these climes.
Are you hinting the movement and migration of tropical species into areas once subtropical or perhaps temperate in climate of species under threat in once warmer regions?
Spot on, old son, precisely. And these are species that will unfortunately be unwelcome, such as Crocodilus porosus, the estuarine crocodile, or salty as we affectionately know it in Oz, the world's largest and ferocious reptiles heading south. Two, the box jellyfish, and the deadly Irukandji stingers too. And in the States, if habitat allows, their migrating birds and alligators will be popping up in regions where they've previously been unknown. And the voters of the carbon trade and global warming had better be ready for themselves for the managing of these problems, which I feel are inevitable.
Inevitable problems, and what are they? What problems do you foresee? And do you think people in both nations will find this a serious deterrent to their lifestyle and take drastic action?
Well, let me explain the beginnings of these wanderings, in particular the gators and the crocs. Coastal southern Queensland and northern New South Wales are situated south of the equator on latitudes not dissimilar to northern maritime Florida and the Louisiana wetland regions. Here in Oz, we currently don't have crocs in these regions, as do our counterparts in the States that have an introduced crocodile species and the alligator in higher latitudinal subtropical regions. The estuarine crocodile, however, are found north from the same latitudes in central Queensland as the Miami region in southern Florida. One third of Australia sits within the tropics, one third within subtropical regions. So much of Australia lies closer to the equator than does the United States, which extends from the subtropics north to cooler regions. Salties require warmer oceans and diurnal temperatures than the American alligator, so they don't frequent the southern Queensland region as yet. Salties also rely on constant heat and humidity to incubate their eggs. However, ocean temperatures in the past decade along the southern Queensland and northern New South Wales coast have been as high as 28 degrees Celsius or the mid-80 Fahrenheit during parts of the summer period. And I'm sure with the trend of global warming, ocean temperature warming, El Nino or otherwise, increases and the abundance of salties in the north, tropical north will see these reptiles move south over summer in search of food and perhaps habitat and mateship. So the outline of a 4-metre croc drifting on the back of the surf line on the Gold Coast may indeed be a reality and a great front page headline throughout Oz, particularly as the ceasing of the culling of croc numbers at the end of last century has allowed their numbers to expand to somewhere in the vicinity of 80,000 in Australia's tropical waters at present, and they are going to need somewhere to live.
What? So panic here? Both nations are going into panic mode.
Well, there are environmental and human-induced factors that will affect them and influence their behaviour of migrating species. That I'll discuss later. But as for panic, yes, I think so. Darwin in the top end of the Northern Territory is my second home, and I know from personal experiences that many Darwinians don't swim in the ocean up there, even in dry season, due to the fear of crocodiles. I do, as I swim on the northern beaches and use the clear water tides for safety in the shallows. Only a maniac would chance the warm box jellyfish induced soup over the monsoon period without a sting suit. That is, unless there's a cyclone swell about and the surfboards roll out to dodge the lightning strikes. I think it would be change a lot of the swimming culture in subtropical regions, especially in areas like the Sunshine Coast north of Brisbane, where it really is only a matter of a few hundred kilometres to where the croc zone starts anyway. And let's say for the deadly stingers. They've had it good for some time. Blue bottle stingers and sharks, their only problem. Oh, and Victorian socialites.
I could imagine two operators would cash in, though, and famous resident Steve Irvine would be kept very busy. Researchers would have to travel less distance to research these scaly beasts from Brisbane University also, don't you think so?
Yep, all very true, Martin. Only public and tourist safety education would need to be instigated, and I'm sure fishery and agricultural practices and wetland and riparian zone management practices too will be developed to accommodate initial visiting and future breeding species in the States and in subtropical Australia. Xenophobia will be rampant. It was okay when they lived in northern Queensland, a fanciful curiosity. But now, a vile reality, they have moved into the neighbourhood. And let's not forget about the tropical mosquito-borne diseases spreading south into more heavily populated regions here. Remember, some of the difficulties seen in the States as far as population management in wilderness areas will impact Australia's environment more than they are now also. And with it, I fear, public outcry for the reintroduction of the culling, that sort of vast drop in crocodile numbers in Australia last century.
Yeah, culling and cruelty. But do you really believe that crocodiles will be so impressed by a busy future port like Brisbane in which to habitate?
Yeah. Ah, now you're talking, Martin. Moreton Bay, Brisbane. Well, I flew over Moreton Bay last year and the year before on the way up to Darwin, and I'm familiar with Brisbane's mangrove regions, which there are aplenty. Only difference between Darwin, for instance, and Brisbane is that Darwin has 36 plus species of mangrove trees abutting dry monsoon vine thickets, whilst in the subtropics the number of species drops rapidly with latitude.
And adequate croc habitat is needed, you believe?
Yep, but all these habitats will diversify with global warming. Sydney, for instance, has but two mangrove species, which will increase to Brisbane's numbers in time, Brisbane's to central Queensland's numbers, etc., etc. As for a busy harbour, I'm sure that large ships will deter crocs to a point, but it comes down more to availability of habitat and prey species. Will fish such as tropical perch become more of a reality further south? We already have fruitback colonies and large numbers of ibis, and I'm sure a few dogs and bovine upstream will go missing from time to time, especially as farms in this part of the world don't always adhere to riparian zone protection laws. Crocs do, however, like marshy riparian reed grass banks to build nests. This could be a problem. Though some of the Melaleuca swamps near Byron Bay look appetising for at least a peekaboo for these large reptiles.
Scary thought, a few hippies walking on water.
Well, there are a few hippies in Darwin, northern Queensland and Florida too that have already had the pleasure. But an acquaintance in Darwin who has a crocodile research doctorate and researches crocodiles on the top end for a living explained to me that anywhere at sea level in the tropics is a possible croc haunt. I used to live near a croc-habituated river in Darwin's northern suburbs near the harbour entrance. So I was questioning my snorkeling safety in the river on the low tide. But I feel quite safe in the escarpment country inland. I'd snorkel down through the rainforest-lying creeks up in the thundery north. In fact, the weather at present here in Nimbin feels a bit like Darwin's monsoon weather, very steamy. I'll be checking the river here too before I hop in. But I seriously doubt that even nation's federal governments will fund me a doctorate scholarship in researching the effects of global warming on croc or gator movements away from traditional areas, do you?
Well, good point. But what are the deterrents of crocodile migration or colonization of once cooler regions from tropical regions and the tropification of the warm, temperate United States and subtropical Australian region, as you put it?
Well, initially, the crocs here will move south only in summer. The winter ocean temperatures will take some time, generations perhaps it is hoped, before we see both diurnal and ocean temperatures to facilitate crocodile processes needs. As with all reptiles, they like the warmth in which to increase metabolic rate, to move about, and this species is fussy. On the other hand, the gators in the States will probably rely more on suitable habitat initially. This is where the equation gets tricky, Martin, as both countries' human populations are still growing, and there may not be adequate space in which to breed, mate, and feed for either species. The linear relationship between time and habitat will markedly differ between the two countries, I feel, in this respect, as I feel the gators will be up against it in terms of casual space, at least.
Mm.
Factors including lack of habitat due to urbanisation and industrial waste incursions on aquatic ecosystems, such as H2O chemical levels and dissolved oxygen levels that affect the prey species they feed on too. Agricultural waste such as unnatural nitrogen and phosphate levels from fertilizer applications inducing eutrophic conditions and algal plumes in river and bay systems. Weed outbreaks where more suitable native plant species habitats are modified, and the poor management of natural hydrology and recharge and discharge sites, as previously mentioned before in the States, and where the decrease, or in fact in some cases increase in sediments downstream, determining variability in wetland formation. This can cause pressure and difficulties within species diversity, desirable plant species and space for bird nesting sites, and crocodile sunning sites in cooler weather. Again, harmful chemical levels building up in these sediments at river mouths and in wetland regions, which no organism can function adequately in some instances, as seen with the fauna mutations in the past in the Florida Everglades in Florida. Oh, and we can't forget those lesson bourgeois rednecks and their shotguns. But don't worry, Australia too has a miserable record in some states when it comes to managing our wetlands. There used to be brolga cranes nesting as far south as Victoria before the waterholes dissipated.
Hmm. Oh, well, guns are there, but what about direct effects by the demons of global warming?
Yes, rising sea level incursions, destroying habitats, and the salination of brackish or freshwater nesting habitats, increased storm surge, sediment upheaval, and shifting due to flooding impacts from increased storm and frequency intensity, fluctuations in temperature affecting ecological function in these regions. The list goes on, Martin.
Yeah, it sounds like war, and one it seems we as human society have produced.
More than likely we have a big play in it all. Someone shifted the climate into another gear, and we're all to blame one way or another, really, in the end.
Well, so how best can we manage these shifts in the behaviour of animals in the States and Australia? Are there any real answers to such problems associated to the impacts of global warming on our ecosystems?
Yes, power to the people. And I don't mean the arrogance of past misadventures, the lunacy of environmental degradation. I mean a concerted, tropified community effort in sustainable wildlife management. We have to get in early and improve our environmental education as a society. Let's prevent fear-mongering and adhere to sensible, democratic ventures. Surfing and other recreational practices will be effective, for example. So we have to understand that these are possibilities and there are realities, and a vote and choose sustainably for all levels of society and government. Let's be mature about this. We increase the effects of global warming, so it is up to us to facilitate the needs of animals and plants seeking refuge in differing, diversifying climatic zones. We might need to cull in some instances, near ports or prime agricultural regions. I personally am not in favour of the wholesale slaughter of wildlife. They're cuddlies all the toothy. But the earlier we realise that this is a reality, we can better our relationship with neighbouring wildlife and include environmental policies and practical fixtures that allow us to live together more harmoniously. And whilst I'm at it, the councils in this region need to forever increase corridor habitats for starters, not decrease them, as we may indeed be accommodating even more winged visitors soon from the north of Queensland and Papua New Guinea.
Well, Ian, this is all very intriguing, but I guess only time will tell just what outcomes will occur in the northern New South Wales, South Queensland border and the southern United States biodiverse regions. But yes, you are justified in saying that we need a concerted early effort as a community in both nations to sustainably manage any problems within ecological and social change. Thank you for talking to us today, Ian.
My many thanks, Martin. You know I love a yarn. And hello to our friends in Canada and the States. Peace.
Well, as you might gather, that Community Radio NIMFM and particularly Scan.org and other programs are featuring local artists, particularly in my show. I've got some young artists who have very, very many difficulties to get on the scene because they've got no money, they've got no name, and they're young, and to be young in this country is actually a sin by itself. So this is the reason I stand up for these people. This is Lani, a young artist. And Lani and Sherry, their sisters, are presenting Boots. Please listen. I'm
My name is Tunji Barry Jackson. I'm an Afro-Australian member of NIMAVAM and advisor on black and white relations. Black people, white people, wrong, not white. Whiteys, they lack pigments. Their genetic potential is underdeveloped. They lack full genetic expression, you see? Black people like myself have the human potentially fully realized. Well, most of us black people, some are coffee color and still can go a fair way. Red-haired and freckled people are to be encouraged. At least they partially develop their human gene pool. Mediterranean whiteys have a better thing. They just got out into the sun more. You fully lacking white whiteys. It will do you good and lift your self-esteem, okay? And to all my black brothers and sisters, I say in solidarity, black is wholly complete human existence. This is Tunji Barry Jackson for NIMFM.
Well, well. You heard the Canadians, and you heard the purpose and destination of the $5 bill. We had an interview with Ian Brown about ecology changes of climate change, moving south with crocodiles and mosquitoes. And we had young artist Lani and Sherry presenting a CD launch track. The track is called Boots. We had also Tunji Barry Jackson on race relations. Thank you for listening. Tune in next week again. You can catch me on NIMFM at nimfm.org via email. You can also check out our Nimbin website, hosting our MP3, which is nimbinradiomedia.libsyn.com. Well, otherwise, if you remember, if in doubt, don't eat the chicken, eat the broccoli.